Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist. You'll find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we talk about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities which are at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are hard to predict, sometimes even hard to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead and that will be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
I am super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
I guess I'm super spectacular.
Oh, that's a good answer. That is an excellent answer. I like that. I think we need a few of these superlative states of being to, you know, so we're not always the same, right? It might get boring to just be super fantastic all the time. Gotta mix it up a little bit. So, what's new in your world? Anything interesting going on?
Well, took the kids this weekend to the air show at the local Air Force Base. Barksdale Air Force Base is right across the river from Shreveport in Bossier City. And it is one of the two Air Force bases in the country that services the B-52s.
Oh, wow.
And it's a pretty big deal as far as the Air Force bases go. And they had the Thunderbirds out there, and that really made an impression on the kids. It was awesome to see these formations going head to head, you know, near Mach 1 and at the last second turning. You know, it's amazing what those guys can do with those airplanes and not crash, you know. So.
They are the I guess the pinnacle of precision flying. Although I know that different branches of the service, I know the Navy also has a group like that, and the Marines do too. So all three of those groups, I'm sure, are all outstanding. I've seen the Thunderbirds, haven't seen the others, and that is quite a show. Now, those B-52s, do they still they're antiques now, right? Do they still have a strategic role of some kind, or I don't think they do.
Absolutely.
Oh, they do.
They do. They have been in service now, I believe, close to 60 years. They plan to keep them in service for 100 years.
Wow.
These particular aircraft can deliver more bombs more economically than any other bomber in the history of the world, and so if the object is to deliver pounds of ordnance, no aircraft can do it better than the B-52. You can take one of those things out and take it to a place where, you know, you're just outside the range of enemy guns, and then you drop a cruise missile,
right?
You know, out of the bomb bay door there, and it takes off like an aircraft and delivers punishment that way. So yeah, it has a huge strategic role and will continue to for the foreseeable future.
I just remember there was a time, actually my entire life up until my early 30s, when they were always in the air. We had Strategic Air Command, and there were always a fleet of B-52s in the air ready for World War III, which could break out at any minute. And eventually, that stood down. I mean, that whole program stood down. But interesting to note that the B-52s are still in operation and still have a major role to play.
That's right. They have been the primary bombers for Afghanistan. They can fly all the way there, deliver their bombs, often they'll make a stop at the island of Diego Garcia and then come back. But they could go to Afghanistan, drop their bombs, and fly home without ever landing.
Well, there you go. So I'm just glad Michael Darling's not with us tonight. He would have no doubt.
He would be
highly amused at my ignorance on this subject. But that's all right. I do know some stuff. So as we will, as we'll try to demonstrate here,
we'll move on to some fields that you know about.
Well, yeah, or at least I've read a few blog posts or something. Actually, we're going to be talking about the age of capability this evening, and I've got a little exercise we're going to do where we track through human capability throughout history. But before we do, there was a really interesting piece that you had made note of about a prior time in our human history. I'm going back about 20,000 years, but back, I guess this will take us back, 100,000 or so years. There's always been this question about what happened to the competing human species that coexisted with Homo sapiens. We know that Homo sapiens and Neanderthals existed at the same time. There's even some possibility that there were some Homo sapiens and Homo erectus at the same time. And I think there might have been a few other offshoot variants that were that were around during that time. So what happened to those other people? How come all that's left is Homo sapiens? And the predominant theory is that we won. We took their territory. We took their food. When opportunity presented itself, we killed them, and they're all gone, and we're still here. But this is a different theory.
Yeah, this according to this group here, these researchers. Let me see. A report in Nature News. Basically, they've issued this paper stating that we followed these genetic markers. We found 600 genetic markers. And we ran this study of these genetic markers over 100 different populations throughout the world. And what they expected to see going backwards in time would be a very neat fanning out of these genetic markers. Well, it wasn't so neat. Let me just read the quote here. If humans bred only with other humans, all these markers would create a neat phylogenetic tree showing that human genetic diversity can be traced to a single population that existed in Africa in the last 100,000 years. Instead, they found evidence that some of these markers looked far too old to have come from humans. Inbreeding with other ancient species is really the only explanation. It means Neanderthals didn't completely disappear, he told Nature. So Well, instead of making war, we made love, apparently. So,
well, there you go.
somehow it's a little comforting to me that the Neanderthals were not destroyed that way, that they were bred out instead of killed. I like that solution to that puzzle a lot better.
Well, I don't want this to turn into some psychoanalyze Phil for pictures that he gets in his head, but for some reason I'm picturing that it was mostly Neanderthal dudes hooking up with Homo sapien chicks. You know what I'm saying? Probably not as much the other way around. I could be completely wrong on that. Okay, but just based on the way things seem to work today, right? That just seems more likely to me. I guess they can't tell that.
I'm going to leave that alone, Phil. I'm going to just not even touch that. So
this reminds me, though, of a story that broke about a year ago, I think. There's this question of when did the ancestors of human beings that led to Lucy and Australopithecus and onto us break off from the ancestors of the chimps? And that goes back quite a bit further, about 6 million years.
Yeah.
But now they're calling that a period of about, I think they say, 4 to 7 million years, because apparently lines would start to break off and then they'd come back together. It's hard to know exactly who the new species is, and so
that makes
a
sense.
Certain level of interaction
population is isolated for a time and it almost becomes its own species, but then it somehow is able to reconnect with its cousins so that it can begin breed back in. It would become one species again. So
Yeah. Very interesting.
Interesting.
So
that
was kind of the long, difficult breakup between humanity and the apes. But we finally got through that, and then we looks like didn't break it off with the Neanderthals. I guess we just sort of brought them into the family. So
that's right.
Interesting stuff. Okay. Well, let's shift gears. We're going to talk about the age of capability. And here's my thesis. All right, I'm sure you will not be surprised to hear me say that I believe that today human beings are far, far more capable. We are empowered. We are able to do far more things in this day and age than in any prior period of human history. And what's exciting to me about that is not just that we're able to do all this cool stuff, but as futurists, looking forward, looking to what the world will be like 10, 20, 50, 100 years from now, where that increase in capability can be expected to go. Because I really think there's been an explosion of human capability over the last century. It maps very closely with the explosion that we've seen in terms of technological capability, and it maps very closely with the explosion that we've seen in the amount of information that we deal with and our ability to manage and deal with information. I see that DC is reeling from the fact that I'm stating my thesis. He says, "Everybody run," but no, stick with me, please, chat room. I think that you know, Sally's not here tonight to keep you amused, so you have to listen to the show tonight. I'm sorry that it worked out that way, but all the best to Sally as she's making her move down south for the warm months. Okay, so her move back north for the warm months. Here's what I want to do. I'm going to take four categories of human capability, and I've got them. I called it strength, but it's kind of power, the ability to move. I'm just going to say weight. Okay, well, just the ability to move a certain amount of mass. That's one. The second one is speed. The third one is the ability to encode information, and the fourth one is the ability to transmit information. Okay, so I'm going to take those four categories, and let's look at where humanity was 20,000 years ago, 1,000 years ago, 500 years ago, 100 years ago, 50 years ago, and today. All right? That's the basic exercise. So we'll start with power, and here I'm just talking about the ability to move stuff. Okay? Nothing any more complicated than that. 20,000 years ago, what was the height of human ability to move stuff?
Well, when were the pyramids built?
The pyramids are going to show up within the 1,000 year range. Although actually they were built about 5,000 years ago, unless you believe pyramid conspiracy theories, in which case it could be 12,000 years ago. But even so,
I don't buy that. Let's go with traditional history and say they're 5,000 years old. Well, and then I guess somewhat before that, or maybe in the same time period, would have been Stonehenge, I guess. So we're talking about even before those things.
That's right.
Okay.
Before even that very rudimentary technology. So just whatever a human being and however many of his buddies he can get an arm under something, right?
Right.
Could lift, I think. I mean, but you know, we're talking 20,000 years ago. There's no real levers or anything. Maybe some crude ones with logs and that sort of thing. But I'm going to be real generous and estimate that the absolute height of human strength, we'll call it a ton, right? If you got really lucky, you got a bunch of people together, you use logs and pulleys and stuff, maybe you could move a ton.
Yeah.
What do you think?
I think that you're being overly generous.
I think that's probably stretching it. We'll say they could move half a ton. How's that?
Yeah, 1,000 pounds. Okay, yeah. I'll go with that. Yeah.
Okay.
But I mean, it was you and a bunch of other big, strong buddies.
That's right. And you're all pushing together and everything works out great and it's downhill, right?
yeah.
Okay, 1,000 years ago, that's right, somewhere in there were the pyramids, and we know that the blocks in the pyramids weigh about 2.5 tons. So that's a nice increase in not automation at that point, but just kind of specialization and understanding of the laws of physics and being able to move things along. Now, I don't think things increased greatly between 1,000 years ago and 500 years ago.
Yeah.
I was trying to think of a good referent for 500 years ago, but I'm skipping that one. I'm going to say it stays about 2.5 tons. 100 years ago.
Well, the internal combustion engine, right?
That's right. So we've got by 100 years ago, we've got trains, and those could be very massive. We're talking about 200, 300, 400 tons, more than that even sometimes. So that's big. And 100 years ago was the 98 years ago was the Titanic, 4,600 tons. So.
Okay.
But I mean, there were ships of that size. It was part of a series of ships. So there's one guy steering the Titanic, and he's moving 4,600 tons. Now, even if you don't think ships count because they float, that's a big jump from 2.5 tons. Okay, just the sheer power that is at the command of the fingertips of a human being increased tremendously.
Yeah,
I don't think there was a big jump after that. I think the Titanic was a high water mark. So that even 50 years ago, I'm not sure that you could have claimed anything bigger. But today, okay, if you want to talk, if you don't mind talking ships, right, you got the Queen Mary. Do you know how much Queen Mary weighs?
I think the Queen Mary is about 4 Titanics, isn't it? It's pretty big.
No, much bigger. 150,000 tons.
Okay.
So that's like 30 Titanics. You can get your head around that, okay? Now, if you say that's... If you say... Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was just saying it's like a city.
Yeah. I mean, it's like a moving city. If you say that's cheating, boats don't count because they're on the water. I'll link to the story of the world's largest machines. There's an Earth-moving machine that weighs 14,000 tons. So we'll call that, 3 Titanics. And it's big on tractor thing, much bigger even than the machine that moves the space shuttles. You've seen that, right? It's on the big tractor wheels.
It moves about 3 miles per hour.
Yeah, slowly roll it out. That thing, that's a piker. It only weighs about 5,000 tons. But this thing weighs about 14,000 tons, and it can move 8.475 million tons of Earth a day. Okay?
Yeah.
So that's the transition we're talking about in terms of human, and one guy drives it. Okay, there's one individual actually steering that thing. So we've gone from, you know, you and your buddies straining yourselves, probably killing yourselves to move a half a ton 20,000 years ago, to one guy moving 150 million tons. That is the increase in human capability where power is concerned over 20,000 years.
He has to take an elevator to his cockpit, right?
You do, yeah. I mean, even that big truck we were talking about, this is a fun page. We'll definitely linked to this, but even that truck, you know, it's like you need a big old cherry picker to get up into the cockpit. Yeah, the cab of the truck to drive it. Okay, next category, speed. 20,000 years ago, how fast could a human being go? Not counting falling.
Not counting falling. We're talking maybe 10, 15 miles per hour at a flat-out run, I guess.
Yeah, you know, I wrote 5 to 10. I don't know what kind of shape they were in, but I'll give you 15. You know, maybe occasionally you get on a canoe and go down some rapids and do 20. I don't know. But that's as good as it's going to get. 1,000 years ago?
Well, horseback.
Right. Which gets you how fast?
Maybe 25 miles an hour?
That's what I was thinking. Tops, you're going to go about 25 miles an hour. You know, if you're a Mongolian warrior on a well-trained horse, I think you're not going to go much faster than that. Okay, then... 500 years ago, same, right?
Yeah. It didn't improve much. You were still you're still on horseback 500 years ago.
Yeah, there's a few outlier horses that can go really fast, but that's about it. There's no major improvement over that period of time. Okay, 100 years ago, how fast could you go?
A locomotive could probably take you 30 or 40 miles per hour up through the Civil War, and then probably got to where they could get a little faster probably towards the end of the 19th century, I would guess.
Right.
40 or 50 miles per hour would be about it at that point.
And okay.
So you doubled your speed. Also, the trains don't wear out like a horse does. So you can
That's right.
Go
They'll keep going.
Further. Yeah.
They will keep pushing. I put 50 to 60, but I'll take your 40 to 50 is probably more accurate. So that's a nice jump, though. At 50 miles an hour, we're now going – at 50 to 60 miles an hour, we're now going – 10 times faster than we could back in the day. So that's a nice jump. Even on a bicycle, suddenly you can reliably go 10 miles an hour for a couple hours if you want to, as opposed to, as you pointed out, top speed was going to be a flat-out run, which you're not going to be able to maintain very long in previous generations. Okay, how about 50 years ago? How fast could a human being go?
Well, at that point, we had automobiles that, and they were already out on the salt flats testing, seeing how fast they could push the automobile, and they probably had broken 200 miles per hour. More than that. We're talking 50 years ago.
Yeah, Chuck Yeager broke the sound barrier in 47, so I'm going to say
people could
at least go 800 to 900 miles an hour, at least.
Okay, that's right. I'd forgotten that it's been that long since Chuck Yeager broke the sound barrier.
Yeah, so probably 50 years ago, by 1960, they were probably doing Mach 4 or 5, something like that. So probably quite a bit more, probably 2,000 miles an hour, something like that. But we'll say, just to be conservative, we don't like to exaggerate, get people all excited. Right, so we'll take it cool. 800-900 miles an hour. Okay, cool. Today, how fast can a human...
What's cool is, though, between the period that Chuck Yeager broke the sound barrier and then the first man in orbit was a period of, 5 years? Talk about a leap.
Yeah,
About
13 20. Years, actually. 13, right, from 47 to... Sputnik was 57, and then Yuri Gagarin was 1960, is that right? 59, 60?
Okay, all right, well, let's say it's that, and so, yeah.
Yeah, so that's a big leap, huh?
Yeah.
That's going to be hard to match, actually, that period of increase in human speed.
Yeah.
Let's say the...
Because we're not going any faster, really, than orbital speeds now. That's about as fast as we go.
Well, low Earth orbit, you're going to go about 17,000 miles per hour. Now, actually, Apollo, 9 years after... Gagarin. At that point, we're into solar orbit, right? We've moved out of orbit of the Earth. We're orbiting the Sun, about to fall into orbit of the Moon, and we're going 25,000 miles an hour.
Yeah.
So
had to break out of the Earth's gravity well. You had to be going faster than orbital speeds. So.
Yeah. So I think
we've actually gone backwards then.
Well, nobody's doing it today, but we're counting it as capability that we have today, I think.
Okay.
We could, right? I mean, we know how to build a machine that'll go 25,000 miles an hour. We're just not doing it right now. So I would say that that currently our speed capability is at 25,000 miles an hour. When you consider we started at 5 to 10, I think we've done pretty well over the last 20,000 years, especially when you consider that 100 years ago, 5 to 10 had only gotten to 50 to 60. And today we're talking about, 50... How many times does 50 go into 25,000? A lot of times, right? 500 times is fast, something like that. So a huge leap in human capability. Okay, now we're going to talk about encoding information. This one is really interesting. 20,000 years ago, what could you do by way of encoding information?
You could speak. That's about it.
Assume language existed, and you could draw a picture.
On the cave walls in France, I guess.
That's right. I mean, that's what you had, okay? You could talk to people. You could say, hey, remember this, okay? And pass it on. But that was, that's about your best hope for encoding information. Or you could say, go look at the cave wall. I drew a picture.
Yeah. You see that big mastodon? I killed that.
Yeah. Here, let me show you the picture.
That was me.
I've told you the story. Now let me show you the picture. And people had a lot of time on their hands, so that whole system worked pretty well 20,000 years ago. But I see. Matt points out that the New Horizon probe is flying to Pluto at close to 100,000 miles per hour, but that is unmanned. So we can make things go 100,000 miles an hour, but that'd be pretty cool if there was a manned spacecraft going that fast. Okay.
The man on it would be going, ah!
Yeah. No, wee! Okay.
Sorry.
1,000 years ago, what could you do? Obviously, everything you could do before. So these are always going to be cumulative with this one. And what else?
Yeah. Right.
You could write.
Getting and writing, yes.
And that's probably the biggest leap until you get to roughly the period we're living in today.
Right.
Because
we rode on changed. I mean, we went from clay tablets to papyrus and then eventually to paper scrolls and then in books and then And so, and then along came the printing press, which was a huge deal.
Right. Absolutely. The ability to write language down. Suddenly, you've got this very crude way of capturing a stream of consciousness, capturing a story, or encoding a person's thoughts. In a sense, the earliest form of digitizing a human being is writing. We were able to put a piece of ourselves someplace else, and that would live on after us if we wrote something down. So that was a huge leap, but pretty crude. And when we get to transmitting information, we'll see that it didn't get as far as we would like. 500 years ago, you already said it, print. Suddenly, not only could you write things down, but you could make many, many, many copies of it. And that will be important when we get over into the transmit side of the world. 100 years ago, we've suddenly got options now.
Okay, tell me about it.
Okay, 100 years ago, in addition to, you know, talking, drawing pictures, writing, and printing, we've got analog sound recording with the phonograph.
Ah, yeah, that's right. And not long after that, we had radio.
That's right. But that you're jumping to transmit, but that's okay.
Okay.
They're closely related.
Okay.
Analog sound recording, analog photography existed at the time. And I believe 1910, Edison was making movies by then, right? So only still photography, but motion picture photography existed 100 years ago.
The oldest movies from Edison's labs and things actually predate the 20th century by just a couple of years.
Oh, okay, well, there you go. So a nice new set of options for how to do the same thing. Suddenly, instead of just writing your thoughts down, you can preserve a person's face in a photograph or their voice with a phonograph or watch them do something, right? This lady can really dance. You don't just have to take my word for it when I write a description of it down. Here, we've filmed the sequence, and now people will always be able to see what that looked like, right? That occurred, suddenly there was a whole new way of encoding that experience. Okay, 50 years ago.
Okay. You're gonna have to help me with that.
What gets added? Yeah, it's a stumper. All I could think of was video.
Yeah.
As opposed to film.
We started having computers, and the oldest computers started being made not long after that. But I don't see how that really helped.
Well,
us,
actually, in fact, that's the other one I've got written here. Yeah, really started developing computer technology during the war, and it took off in a big way after the war. And I've got magnetic computer storage listed as maybe the biggest one to come along since writing, although an even bigger one in terms of transmission comes along shortly thereafter. But, yeah, that's a huge leap when instead of analog writing down of text, we've got this ability to record and store data in this completely new way of dealing with it, a structured way of dealing with it, of being able to search it, being able to perform calculations on it, just a major leap forward when computers show up. Okay, so how about today? What do we got?
Okay, well, obviously the internet it's been the huge big deal. It was born the same year I was, 1969, but it didn't really show up until in my life. It didn't start affecting the lives of normal people until I was already graduated from college.
Right.
And then all of a sudden it exploded. Into the world and changed everything. So yeah.
Okay, we'll come back to the internet because it's a transmit thing, not actually an encode thing. But
okay.
In fact, it is both. I mean, at this point, you kind of break the paradigm kind of breaks, doesn't it?
Right.
The distinction between the two just about disappears when you start thinking about the internet. But we'll come back to that in just a minute.
I guess that's why I'm having trouble making the distinction.
Yeah, it is. I couldn't think of any others. All I could say was everything that had come before, all the previous methods of encoding, digitized, and this is huge, available to just about everyone, which is a big difference. Anybody could talk. Anybody could draw a picture. Anybody could write. Not anybody had a printing press 500 years ago. Everybody has a printing press now, which is an interesting change. Not everyone had a camera 100 years ago. Everybody's got a camera now. You think about it, 100 years ago, or let's call it like 75 years ago, if you had the capability to make a motion picture, you were rich, right?
Yeah.
Think of who you had to be to pull that off. And now we've got how many million people putting stuff up on YouTube?
Yeah.
Every day. So it's all of the different methods we've had of encoding now digitally available. So it's the marriage of all our previous forms of encoding with that computer technology and universally available. Okay, so this is huge. Now we're going to talk about transmitting information. And you're right. Down the road, they blend into one thing. Okay, so 20,000 years ago, what was your best bet for transmitting a message, conveying it out to as many people as possible?
Okay, 20,000 years ago, that would be yelling.
That is the word I have written here, yell. Yeah. Either say, hey, everybody go look at the picture I drew on the cave wall, or stand up and shout, right? I killed the mastodon, right? That was it. That's all you had. How about 1,000 years ago?
Or rather, it might be, I thought I killed the mastodon. Run. Okay.
Yeah, you know, they're probably a better reason to yell, actually, when you think about it. And people need to be motivated to yell. The great thing about that age was, I guess if you really weren't interested in somebody's message, you could just literally walk away from it, right? Nobody
right.
could force a message on you that you didn't want. How about 1,000 years ago?
Okay, well, let's say you're a king,
mm-hmm.
and you have an army of scribes. You could walk in to a room with, you know, 10 scribes and say, I want all of the sections of my kingdom to pay taxes of a certain amount, and you're to take, you know, each of you to write down what I'm saying here and take it to the far corners of my kingdom, and that'll pass that message along. Once they wrote it down, as fast as someone could run or maybe get on a horse, that could take your message out to various corners of your kingdom if you were a king. So I guess that's transmitting by actually physically moving the paper.
Yeah, if you could get someone, if you get scribes to do it, you could hand out, write and distribute copies of whatever it was that you wanted to pass out. So you didn't just have to yell. You could make copies, and yeah, you would probably be a king. You'd have to be a person of some major influence to get very far with this method, because you would need resources at your disposal. At this point in history, we're talking about slaves, right? We're talking about people that you could say, okay, you sit here, you keep dipping this nib into the, you know, take the quill into the ink, and just keep writing, okay? All day, every day.
And be thankful for this job, slave. There are worse jobs.
That's right. So there was, in a sense, the possibility for sort of mass distribution, but it was very crude, and it was extremely limited to the top of the food chain, and no particular reason to do it. You really just needed a few copies, because there were only a few people you ever need to give a message to, probably, you know, because there weren't that many people who could read them. It's a very, very, very limited thing, but it did represent a huge step forward from make somebody go look at the cave or yell at them. How about 500 years ago?
Well, by then there were actual books by that point.
Absolutely.
And those books, they were very, very rare. Back during the Middle Ages, if you had more than maybe one book, or even one book would be a priceless heirloom.
Absolutely.
And you would keep it forever, and it would be passed down from generation to generation. So I guess you're transmitting not only by distance, but also through time. So.
That's right. Yeah, a real permanence to the invention of binding books. And you combine
right.
that with the technology we talked about earlier, which is printing, and suddenly you've got a real capability to mass produce much more longer-term storage information than people were able to to produce before. And yeah, with the printing press, suddenly there's an explosion of literacy. They're still rare. They're still expensive. I was watching. Ever watch Antiques Roadshow?
Yeah, I think I've seen it a couple times. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's on PBS. We watched the American version is cool, and the British version is also really interesting. And actually, now that I've made that distinction, I don't remember which one this was, but a woman had a book, and it was in Latin, and it was obviously from the binding. It was right around from the period, you know, I mean, just post-Gutenberg, maybe 20 years, something like that.
Right.
She was under the impression that it was a Gutenberg Bible. Her father had paid several thousand dollars for it from a neighbor back in the 70s. And they're looking at it, and they're going, well, no, I'm sorry, that's not what this is at all. It's part of a set of three volumes. It was the Meditations of Saint somebody, I don't remember who. And while rare, it certainly doesn't rise to the Gutenberg Bible level, and your dad paid $5,000 or $6,000 for it. Even today, a whole set of these could be acquired for about $1,500. And it was like, oh, wow, what a drag. She paid so much money for the book. And they said, except for there's one thing. And on the inside cover, there was an inscription, and this book belonged to Henry the VII.
So this changes things.
Yeah, this changes things considerably. But to me, what was interesting about that was, to your point about how rare books were, the King of England considered it worth his while to write in there, you know, this book belongs to Henry the King of England. So
yeah, so lay your hands off. You know?
Yeah. If found, please return to, you know, the Tower of London, I guess, you know, wherever he was staying at the time.
Yeah.
But it's a big jump forward. Okay, so how about 100 years ago?
Okay, we're transmitting by the telegraph. So Samuel Morse had his insight and delivered the telegraph by that point.
That's
in fact,
the telegraph.
The telegraph predates the Civil War. So.
Yeah, telegraph had been around for a while. Telephone we had by then, as you pointed out earlier. Radio we had by then.
Mm-hmm.
We also had printing that was based on photography so that you could have mass production of photographs. You could have mass production of recordings. We were talking about the phonograph, and it was possible by then to make those little cylinders and you know, make thousands of copies of an audio recording. So a real explosion, just as our choices of how to encode information increased, our transmission channels increased tremendously too. Okay, 50 years ago.
Okay, the best transmission method 50 years ago, television, I guess, would have
TV, right?
About
that technically invented in the late 20s, experimental broadcasts in the 30s, but really kind of came in its own in the 1950s, and major impact on society and really civilization when you think about it. Okay, how about today? That finally leads us to where encoding and transmission meet, and that's what you pointed out earlier.
That is the Internet.
Internet.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So you've got all these different methods of transmitting the information that you've encoded. And yeah, you don't even know what you're doing. When you blog, what are you doing? Are you encoding or are you transmitting? We're doing both at the same time. When we podcast, that's what we're doing. When people put tweets up on Twitter, that's what they're doing. Facebook, YouTube, right? There's a simultaneity between encoding and transmitting, and it seems that the medium of encoding has essentially merged with, as you said, the medium of transmission. The two things have become the same. So now, finally, we spent more than 5 minutes going through this.
Yeah, we sure did.
The intention was we'd get through this in 5 minutes so we could talk about the future. But now let's talk about where do these go next, okay? So I think looking back over the four categories, we can agree that We've made substantial progress in all of them over 20,000 years, and these are not the only categories that were possible. There were lots of other things we could have talked about, but I tried to think of some basic important capabilities that people could relate to. Now, the question is, the other observation I want to make is, I think we made good progress, but really it started speeding up about 100 years ago.
Yeah.
On the scale I'm using, it's really about 200 years ago that the increase started. And then those who are familiar with the law of accelerating returns, who've read Ray Kurzweil, that you know that about the time of the Industrial Revolution, a lot of things start happening, a lot faster, and our capabilities increase tremendously over that period of time. But on this scale, from 100 to 500 to 100, it's in that range. In the last 100 years, things have really taken off. The last 50 years, things have really taken off. So what happens going forward in terms of the ability of human beings to move mass? Do you see that one changing massively?
Well, one thing I see is that the ability of a person, an individual, to do things has multiplied. And by that I mean not just kings anymore, but just normal, everyday Joes can, for one thing, they can get in their car and attach their car or truck to a trailer and move, several tons all at once. And, and that capability, I guess that, we already, there were some who could do it even 50 years ago, but nowadays, normal people can afford, big size vehicles and can move serious poundage with that, right now. So, some of these things, though, like moving weight, we may have maxed out on, at least for individuals.
We may have.
I'm not sure.
We could be close to a maximum. Although one of the things we talk about on this program, and at the Speculist, is the idea of how increasingly these capabilities do get democratized, and they do get passed into the hands of individual people. I think about like when I use my snowblower, which I only got to use twice this year. I got it for Christmas. But that's only doing something faster. I'm not actually moving more snow than I was before. I'm actually making it happen a lot faster, right? Because it's got this four-cycle engine pushing the snow along. But that's quite a that's quite an interesting thing that just a regular guy can own a snowblower. I wonder
right.
if 50 years ago, if a regular guy owned a snowblower. I'm not sure that he did. Certainly 100 years ago, a regular guy didn't own a snowblower.
A regular guy have a really nice zero-turn radius lawnmower.
Exactly.
That can mow 3 or 4 acres in a couple of hours without any hassle. That for me is kind of a big deal to be able to to get that little chore knocked out.
Well, one of the capabilities that we look at going forward is I know you saw the story in Pop Science recommended to us by our buddy Michael Darling. The HP DesignJet 3D printer, now on sale, churns out solid plastic objects from the desktop. So this is HP, a major player in the IT space, getting into the replication business, the fab lab business. This is been very much the domain of hackers and hobbyists up to this point. We've talked about that phenomenon of it even becoming a hobby over the last few years, which is pretty remarkable. But now this is a product
a lot of these machines, 10 years ago they were called rapid prototypers, and some of them still are. And they major corporations might have one or two of them just to shoot out a prototype of what their new gadget would look like or something. That was probably that was the domain of large corporations, and they were huge, very expensive machines.
Right.
And now you put them on your desktop and prototype your own.
You can get this one from HP for $17,000. Still quite a bit of money.
Yeah.
But I can remember a time when a laser printer cost about that much.
Right.
It's probably
still not going to be something unless you're a pretty wealthy person. This is probably not something you're going to buy yet, but a medium-sized business could definitely buy it. And
assuming they have a need for it, and it's interesting that the need is increasing as the availability of this technology is increasing. But where does this technology take us eventually? Okay, so these things become more widespread, they become cheaper, and they become much more capable. What's our end game, Stephen? We talk about this all the time. What are we going to end up with through the progression of prototyper technology?
This is, I think, the bridge technology to nanofactories. Ultimately, one day, hopefully, we have nanofactories that can build from the molecular level up anything we, pretty much would want. But in the meantime, what we could have is a fab lab that's very capable of printing out, a piece of plastic with electronics within it. Basically, any gadget that you can imagine. And you print it out in just a few minutes, and there you go. You need a calculator, bang, you got one. You need a MP3 player. You need a small computer. We'll print it. We can print that out for you. So
or even a big computer, but nobody needs a big computer anymore because
yeah, true.
They're all small.
You need another computer. You need another printer.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's the thing. Ultimately, we're talking about, end game is going to be the universal assembler, nanotechnology-driven, atomically precise, universal assembler, a machine that can make anything. But even before you get to that, there's an awful lot of pretty cool stuff you can do just with the principles being demonstrated here, I think, at a very early, very immature level with the HP DesignJet 3D fabrication machine. You take that fabrication technology ahead a few generations, and you've got people in their backyards, in their garages, making truly interesting and, I think, in some cases, very large-scale objects that previously hadn't existed. We did a program, I guess, about a year ago about the guy who had built his own 1/10 scale model of the Apollo spacecraft.
Yeah.
And he just did that with tools you have, I mean, he didn't need any fabrication technology for that. You put this kind of capability in people's hands, and as potentially scary as it might sound, you've got people building their own 13,000-ton earth-moving machines or Queen Marys or what have you. I think that the upper limit may not move up that much, but the distribution of it into the hands of the populace will definitely increase. And I think probably the next big technological revolution in terms of moving stuff is going to be when we have a space elevator. That'll probably be our next big kind of capability. And that isn't so much the weight that it's able to carry, although it will be able to push quite a bit of weight up, but just the distance that you can send it. That'll be absolutely, without using a rocket, without relying on that kind of propulsion, but just a piece of machinery that can move something thousands of miles off the surface of the Earth into space, that's going to be, I think, that might be the pinnacle of human, what do I want to say, material movement capability. Actually, it won't be. Eventually we'll build Dyson spheres and all kinds of things, but it'll be a big one for sure when it comes. So, looking forward to seeing all those, but I think even the modest beginnings of that is going to be very exciting. Okay, how about speed? How fast are we going to go?
Well, for one thing, I hope that we're going back to the moon at some point, so we'll be going as fast as Apollo. But we'll need to go faster if we choose to go to Mars, and I suspect that sometime within the next 100 years. Somebody will get there.
I think so too. Yeah, I think we'll go back to the moon. We'll go to Mars. Ultimately, we'll push on out into other parts of the solar system, and we'll. I don't know how fast that means. We'll go. Matt's suggestion that we send people 100,000 miles per hour sounds pretty good. The ultimate speed limit, of course, is 186,000 miles per second. We'll never build a spaceship that can go that fast. That is the ultimate speed limit of the universe, the speed of light. But here's an interesting thing to consider about how fast we can go, and it goes to the democratization of this capability too. It goes to the fact that this capability becomes more widespread. in effect, we're able to move great distances very fast today through communication,
right?
Which is cool. But ultimately, we're looking for a true virtual telepresence, the ability to effectively have the experience of being someplace other than where you actually are through virtual reality and really good bandwidth and good computing technology. And when we have that, essentially you'll have the ability of people to travel at light speed, roughly light speed, 186,000 miles per second, anywhere in the world that that has a node for the VR software to access. So again, maybe it's not that we're all going to be in spaceships going really fast, but even those of us who are here on Earth are going to have this incredible ability to move very fast from one place to the next, or at least to have the experience of doing that. And to me, that's good enough.
Yeah.
I don't know. Am I cheating, or does that count?
No. I think that's the fact that we're at some point our transmission and our traveling could actually merge. I could see that happening. It depends on how into the virtual world we choose, how deep into the virtual world we choose to move. If you can imagine somebody going all the way with it and becoming basically a digital personality, they could move at the speed of light.
That's a really great point. We talked a minute ago about how our encoding and our transmission kind of merged into one place. Our transportation could merge in there too, and ultimately, where it really matters, our ability to move stuff around. I mean, even today, you can go into Second Life and fly, right? You have capabilities there that we don't have anywhere else. Certainly, you can move any object, no matter how heavy, in Second Life because objects don't have weight there. But yeah, all these categories sort of break down the deeper you get into the digital world, don't they?
Yeah.
They become sort of one category. Okay, so how about our ability to either encode or transmit information? We'll count that as one thing going forward into the future. How do those change? What comes next?
I would think one thing that would change is our own intelligence. I'm limited by the amount of information that I can encode and transmit, in large part by how fast I can think.
Right.
If I only think at a certain level, I'm not going to transmit more information than I can think at any one time, unless I save it up and just shoot it out all at once. But if I'm much more intelligent and have a lot more bandwidth within my head, then I could obviously transmit more information at one time. So I suppose that would be probably one of the next big steps in the encoding and transmission of information, is that people get a lot smarter.
I think you're right. I when you think about it, that's in a sense what's happened with each of these stages around encoding and transmitting information. There's been a, I don't know, is it cause or effect? But our intelligence increased when we started drawing pictures on cables. Did we start drawing pictures because we were getting smarter, or were we getting smarter because we were keeping track of more things? Certainly, you can think that the intelligence of the species increased dramatically when we were able to write things down, keep records, keep history, and not have to keep relearning everything every generation. And when you add print technology to that, maybe not individuals, although I think individuals did get smarter, but we as humanity, as a civilization, our intelligence has increased exponentially thanks to those technologies. And those weren't even the fast, lay-it-on-thick technologies that we get to here in the last 50 to 100 years. Suddenly, when you're talking about the Internet, and when you're talking about Moore's Law and just the increases in capability around computer technology, I think that whether it's done through some kind of actual augmentation or whether it's just the result of the fact that we're interacting with this technology in much more intimate, much more connected ways, we're going to get a lot smarter. I think that's a really good point. There's just our ability to encode information inside ourselves is going to increase. And the flip side of that, I think, is the rest of the story, which is something I've already referenced. We talk about telepresence. We talk about ultimately uploading a human being. Ultimately, we're able to encode, we believe, not just the impressions of a person, not just the physical appearance of a person, not just the motions of a person, but the actual personality of that person into the new substrate. When we can encode a human being, when we can encode a mind, I think we've gone as far as I can imagine. I guess that is the upper limit of encoding that I can get my head around. But at that point, transmission becomes the ability to move that encoded being anywhere within that network, anywhere within a vastly expanding and vastly expanding world of virtually unlimited possibilities. And there's kind of a pun in the word virtual there when you think about it. Virtually unlimited possibility.
That's right. Literally.
Yeah, literally virtually. No, when I say virtually, never mind. So that's what I think we've got to look forward to. I think our capabilities have increased in ways that people from earlier periods would not have been able to imagine. And one of our commenters was saying earlier, would have been frightened by to have heard about them. And I think there are a lot of people even today, if you talk about encoding a human personality and sending it over a computer network, that sounds a little bit off-putting. That sounds a little bit scary. But I actually think that that will be considered a very mainstream idea very shortly, and it will become something that that we see happening in our lifetimes. And what comes beyond that, Stephen, I guess that's why they call it the singularity. I don't know where our capability goes.
Our ability to forecast beyond greater than human intelligence, what can we say with human minds about what people that are smarter than us will do? So.
Yeah, exactly. Smarter, faster, thousands of times more capable than we are today. All I know is I bet it'll be cool, and I bet it'll be really fun. So
and
with that,
what's
our music?
Our music is Rise Above by Jeff Silver.
Well, there you go. Rise Above. That's exactly what we're talking about doing. We're going to increase our capabilities, and we're going to rise above. And his name, I'm sorry, again?
Jeff Silver.
All right, Jeff Silver sings Rise Above. Well, thanks, Stephen. This has been great as always. I want to thank our chatters for keeping it going tonight. Without Sally there, you still managed to have a good chat going. Everyone listening to the program live and everyone listening to us via recording, thanks for being part of Fast Forward Radio. We will be on Wednesday nights from here on, and we will be back again next week with another Fast Forward Radio. Until then, live to see it.
My whole world is about to bust wide open, like the devil climbed inside and tried to take control. Drag me down till I feel I might be. Troubles, I can feel it in my bones. I will rise above and then I'll soar away from here. Rise above, rise above. My life will be far sweeter when I rise. I would cry, but once I start, there'd be no stopping. I might drown in my own. It's not about